Connie Willis is the award-winning author of Doomsday Book, Passage, To Say Nothing of the Dog, and Bellwether. Connie has been awarded 11 Hugo Awards, 11 Locus Poll Awards, and 8 Nebula Awards. The two halves of her newest novel, Blackout and All Clear, were published in 2010.
I will say, first off, congratulations.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I'm very excited. It was very exciting.
Yeah.
Incredible. It was very exciting. And people kept saying, do you not care? You know, you've won so many times. They're like, oh, you have to be kidding. I really care. So.
So tell us a little bit about Blackout and All Clear. And I guess, you know, everyone and their brothers probably read the books by now.
Oh.
But tell us a little bit about...
Okay.
How it's been the last
couple of years. Okay. Well, the idea for Blackout and All Clear came from the very first time travel story that I wrote was Firewatch. And it was about a historian who mistakenly gets sent back to St. Paul's Cathedral to be a member of the Firewatch. There's been a snafu thing. And so he's very unprepared and he's very crabby through the entire thing, as one would be. And I did all this research on the Blitz and for the story, and all this research on World War II. I've always loved World War II. And so, well, not loved it, you know, but been fascinated by it.
Yeah.
And so so I wrote that, and then I moved on, and I at the time, I just intended that to be a standalone story. And then I decided to do Doomsday Book, which was set in the Middle Ages, but with the same world where Oxford has historians, and Mr. Dunworthy was a character in that, and then I did To Say Nothing of the Dog, which was set in Victorian England.
Right.
I mostly did that because I had such a huge body count in Doomsday Book, and
but you needed to lighten things up.
and I felt that, you know, history is not just all the awful things that happen. That's what tends to get written down, but it's also the, you know, the tea parties and the romances and the fun things.
My wife is the only book of yours that she's read is To Say Nothing of the Dog, and she loved it. I don't want to tell it. You know, it's not all that. It's not all that light.
Yeah, she's sometimes grim, yes. So anyway, so I was progressing along there, and but I all the time I had not gotten it out of my system. Mm-hmm. The World War II was still there, and I had all this great research that I could use. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you kind of hinted at some of the same elements in To Say Nothing of the Dog, though, the burning cathedral.
Right, in Coventry, Cathedral. And then I did a couple of other stories. I did one called The Winds of Marble Arch, which talked about the tube shelters in World War II. And then I did a story called Jack, which is about a vampire in the Blitz who works on a rescue team.
Oh.
It seemed like a good spot. You could, a lot of, you know, it's a time when... the kind of the brakes are off, and there are a lot of dead bodies around, so you can kind of get away with murder if you want to. And I had originally intended him to just be a vampire who was taking advantage of that situation. Then I was thinking it would be kind of cool if you were somebody who had a lot of self-loathing, like a vampire would, and suddenly you found an opportunity to make use of your talents that would, and you could be a hero, you know. So anyway, so none of this helped. I still didn't have it out of my system. So I thought, all right, I'm just going to write a book. And it was supposed to be one volume, and then it grew. At one point, it had grown into three, and then I managed to squish it back down into two. But I would like to say that I have it completely out of my system now, but I don't know. I had to do so much more interesting research while doing the book than that there's all this other great stuff.
There's such an obvious passion for the subject matter in the books, and it really shines through. And then I actually listened to the audiobook of All Clear, and I believe there's an interview with you at the beginning, or you say at the beginning how you had worked with, or you met some of the ambulance drivers.
Yes.
How much did that research, how did you build the book around the research?
Well, it was, you know, there's all the specific research, you know, what do things look like, what burned down when, all these different, you know, horrible details that you need to get right. And then that's actually the easier research. The hard research is when you're trying to get a feel for what the book should be about and a feel for what the times were like. And we had this great, great opportunity, thanks to my wonderful husband, who we went to the Imperial War Museum because they had a great Blitz exhibit. And the plan was that I was going to take notes all morning and he was just going to wander around the museum. And 15 minutes into my taking notes, he came back and said, "You have to come with me right now. I have something to show you." And I said, "Oh, come on, I'm working. Can it wait till lunch? We'll do this later." And he's like, "No, no, you have to come." And I'm like, "This had better be good." And so I went with him, and oh, it was good. It was a free day at the museum for anyone who had worked during World War II. And so on emergency services. And so he had collected these old ladies who had all, this was 1995, so it was one of the anniversaries. And they had all been ambulance drivers and canteen workers, and I think one had worked on an anti-aircraft gunner, and they were drivers, and they were all these different things. And he had bought them all tea and cookies and sat them down so I could
held
them hostage so I could come interview them. What was fascinating was I already knew most of what they told me. I mean, it wasn't that they gave me facts, but they gave me just a feeling of what it was like, and also their cheerfulness and their positive outlook on life. I mean, they were having a wonderful time, and they remembered it as a wonderful time, which really surprised me. You're not used to thinking of it as a wonderful time. You know?
Had you already been planning that plot line in Blackout and All
Clear? I had not planned to use these particular people in my book, yeah. But I had definitely, you know, it seemed like a place that was not so much a horrible, grim thing as something where everything was heightened. Fun was heightened, love was heightened, danger was heightened. Everything is you know, when you're going to die the next day maybe, or the next minute, you have a totally different attitude toward life. And so I wanted to get some of that fun into it. I didn't want it to just be another grim. Some review said that it was way too upbeat a version of the war, and I'm like, well, you know, it isn't all bad all the time.
Well,
and people still had
people
had fun during the war. These elderly ladies had said to me, I said, "You know, you guys sound like this was just really fun." And they said, "Well, you know, we were young. We were in London alone for the first time. And there were all these men." And I was like, "So it was fun, huh?"
Yeah.
And of course, that's part of it too.
Right.
You know, and of course, I think whatever you're raised in, whatever you grew up in, that period when you were young, what you really remember fondly is the fact that you were young, and almost anything can be fun. So I wanted to capture a little of that. And then when I did my research on the evacuated kids, of course, I just really pulled out all the stops because I love Alf and Vinny. I know I've had people say they're the most horrible children. I'm like, I love Alf and Vinny.
I was going to ask about where the Hodmans came from.
They are my favorite characters.
I loved every scene they were in, just the pages just lit up.
Well, everything they did, all the awful things they did, were things that one or another evacuated child actually did. They really were, but they're just kids, you know, and for kids, you know, I have to say, I was very inspired by the movie Hope and Glory, which is a wonderful portrayal of what it's like to have been a kid during the war. And then they've got a lot of spunk there. And you know, we need that. I'm reaching the age now of the horrible illness of old foginess, where you sit around going, you know, "Get off of my lawn, you kids! The kids today." You know?
It sounds like it. I can tell from you.
And all my friends do a lot of that. You know, the kids today.
Man.
And I spend half my life at Starbucks. Mm-hmm. That's where I do my writing. And so, and the kids are great. They're great. I don't know, people who say that clearly have nothing to do with younger people. And every kid I know I'm perfectly happy to turn the world over to them because they seem so much more intelligent than I was at that age and so much more cheerful. And I think if anything will defeat the world, it is this sort of, you know, it's all going to pieces. Of course, the world does go to pieces. It all goes to pieces for every person because you start out with all these shining hopes, and then as you get older, what you see the world as you are, not as it is. And right. So as you get older, you tend, I think, to see it unraveling like you're unraveling, you know? So I want to avoid that if I can.
Go ahead.
Do you think writing in public kind of gives that philanthropic thread, on, you know, in your writing where it's...
Maybe a little bit. Yeah, I think it's terribly important to be connected. I work with the English Honor Society at my husband's university, and we have a wonderful time. And I think it just helps to be around people that with different viewpoints. I think you know, everybody has in them that ranting letter to the editor writing person. and I myself, when spending too much time on political websites, find that turn into that person, the old crank. And I'm an old liberal crank, which is slightly different from being an old conservative crank, but not much. And so, you know, I try to avoid that by getting out and getting reality checks. Absolutely. I think college campuses are just to be around young people and to, you know, because you're constantly getting that reality check versus the, you know, my husband's taught, he's just semi-retiring now, and he has taught for, let's see, he taught high school and then he taught college. I think he's taught for close to 40 years. He sees no difference in the kids. He sees them, they're still, you know, some of them are still really dumb and some are real smart and some are, you know, selfish beyond belief, and some are just unbelievably mature, and you know, there's just, you know, they're the same, which is what gives me hope that I can still write and appeal to a younger you know, audience.
Now this perspective of, you know, as you age, the world kind of, you know, it presents its challenges for every individual, and they have to, you know, change their outlook to match what their life
right,
has meant.
Right.
Is that kind of part of what inspired the tribulations that you put Mr. Dunworthy through? And
oh,
all
poor
clear.
Mr. Dunworthy.
He goes through some really tough times.
He goes through some tough times in all my books. Poor man. I can relate very much to, you know, Mr. Dunworthy is that part of me that's always fretting and stewing. And the worst thing about, as you get older, you collect all this data on what can go wrong. You know, you know somebody who was at the height of their powers and got sick, and you know somebody that this awful thing happened to, and you know somebody who fell down a well. you know all these things. And so you start losing your ability to face the world fearlessly because you just know too much. You know that if you go out and have a picnic, you can be stung by a hornet and swell up and die right there. You know, so it has a cumulative effect, I think. And Mr. Dunworthy represents always that cumulative effect of me being terrified of the world. So, and so then I try to put my younger people, you know, in
there with him
to kind of, yeah,
bit.
To lift him up a little bit.
Oh, are there any other characters that you think your elements of your personality have kind of
gotten
important
to? I am all
of
my characters. Yeah. I base all of my characters on me. Except I was a much better behaved child than Alf and Binny. I wish I had been Alf and Binny, but I was too neurotic even as a kid.
So actually, speaking about your past then, I read in a blog entry you had, I think a couple years back, talking about why write about time travel, and you said, I love the possibility that we could go back to put to the past and change mistakes we make, which I'm always wishing I could do.
Yeah,
so I was curious,
that's true.
What are some of the mistakes you wish you could go back and change?
Oh, you know, careless things that hurt people, and just being, especially when I was in high school and college, when I was so self-involved and could not see beyond my own nose. I think that's the problem for everybody at that age. You think the whole world centers on you, and the horrible pimple on the end of your nose kind of thing, whole world is looking, and you don't realize that everybody else is, they have their own problems. They're not paying any attention to you. And just bad things like that where I look back and I think, oh, you moron, you know, you didn't get that's what this person was trying to say to you, or you didn't understand that this is where they were coming from, you know. And it would be nice to be able to fix those, but you can't. I mean, I think the thing I object most to in certain kinds of literature, movies, and TV and things, books, all of them, is when mistakes are too ultimately fixable. You know, when you you know, Spock is dead, and then, but he's not really. It's
but
fine.
He was on the Genesis. Planet.
It's really so fine. Exactly. Exactly. And I want, and or the thing where you've gone back in time and you've changed everything, you messed it all, but just it doesn't matter because there's 1,000 timelines, and in one of them everything has gone right. And I'm like, no, I always want in my books for consequences to be real and loss to be real, and because if loss isn't real, then love isn't real either, and you know, self-sacrifice isn't real. None of those things get everything is devalued if nothing is permanent. So when my people die, they stay dead, you know. And right.
How difficult was it? This spoiler warning, yeah, okay. To write about Mike's sacrifice.
Oh. You know, that one actually was very personal for me. My uncle was killed at Guadalcanal, and he was on a munition ship, and it blew up. They don't know if it was sabotage it was a munition ship. Munition ships blow up, so they don't know. Terrible, terrible time where no one was notified. They were officially missing in action, but... my grandmother said that the grapevine, of course, of the people who were still alive would write their parents, mm-hmm. and then they would write other parents. And so by the time they got the official word of what had happened, they all knew what had happened, yeah. and had known it for months, which I think is a particular kind of hell, you know, to know it without ever having gotten the official word. But also, my uncle was supposed to have shore leave that day, and he traded with his best friend, because his best friend had a date.
Wow.
And so he shouldn't have been on the ship, but he was. And the best friend wrote my grandmother faithfully for the rest of his life. He felt so guilty about what he'd done. Of course, he hadn't done anything, but you know, just that sense. So, but those people, the people who they died for us. They mm-hmm. sacrificed themselves for us and for each other. You know, they died for their friends, and they died for the country, and they died for all of us. And Mike would do anything for mm-hmm. those girls. Mm-hmm. And he would, I don't think he would have been sorry, you know, that he did it.
Right.
If he could have known that that he had accomplished
really
that, he would have been perfectly willing to
absolutely.
Do that. But I'm not saying that's the only thing Mike is based on. He's based on a million guys who did that kind of thing. But for me, I had always thought that was a particular, you know, tragedy. And then the tragedy that you don't know, you know, my uncle never knew that we won the war,
right.
you know, or what. And people who died in the Blitz when things looked so black, you know. The hardest thing for me was to put myself in the mindset of the people living through it. And I put at the top of every page that I was writing, they don't know they won.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
because
absolutely.
Hitler was coming, and he was coming fast, and he had just sliced through Europe. And
looked unstoppable.
He looked right. totally unstoppable. And I tried to get across a little bit of that feeling that, you know, you come up out of that shelter in the morning, and there could be German tanks rolling down that street.
It came across. And actually, interesting, the time travel aspect of it, and the concerns the historians feel for whether or not they are having an influence on events and altering the timeline. There's that scene when I believe it's Mike is in the hospital, and one of the other patients starts screaming out, they're coming
right,
up the channel!
Right.
Like the, and as a reader, you think, they really are.
They could be.
and I think that really helped to
right.
get you the mindset of, no, there's this terror and there's this
right.
know, uncertainty.
The uncertainty for the people living through it, and then the uncertainty for my poor, immovable time travelers who are terrified to take a step for fear
right.
of what they might be stepping on, you know.
Right.
And that, which I think is an awful position to be in. The more you know, the harder it is. So. Mm-hmm.
In your stories, you seem to be conveying a certain essence of this era, of these people. Have you ever considered applying that to writing nonfiction with your research, or is this, do you feel, your best way to tell this essence of this history through?
I think in another life I might easily have become a historian and tried to focus on, you know, the nonfiction. I think fiction for me is the best way to tell these stories and to get the history across. I I'm not tied to, you know, trying to be a neutral observer. I can be as biased as I want, and I was really biased here. I'm totally biased in favor of the individual and biased in favor of the personal, that we all have a stake in history. That's been a running theme through all the time travel stuff, is that there aren't any big guys and little guys in history, no matter what Rupert Murdoch may think. They're all people are relevant and all people are critical, and you don't know. You never know.
Is that why your books focus so much more on the, you know, boots on the ground, everyman history, rather than having, you know, Winston Churchill show up?
Yeah, well, two reasons, yeah. Especially in this book, where it is, the whole point is that this war was won by, yes, you know, by Sir Godfrey and by Polly and by all these, you know, by Viv and the kids and everybody. I mean, that's who won the war. I really believe that. I mean, it was my premise going in, but then the more stuff I found, the more I was convinced that this was, in fact, the People's War. But then my second thing is, I have a couple of walk-ons in this book of famous people. I hate it when people put words in the mouths of real people, you know, and have them doing things that you have no grounds for knowing that they would do it. I have thrown more than one book against the wall because somebody was telling me what Mark Twain had said or done, or, you know, or what Abraham Lincoln had said or done. I just think we can look at them doing the things that we know they did, but I think we don't have any right to. It's just ghoulish somehow. I would be furious if anybody tried to, you know, deduce my motives at any particular point, and have been furious, because I think there's a certain kind of literary criticism that's, well, if such and such was writing about this, they must have been thinking about this and doing this, and all this nonsense right now about Shakespeare and Anonymous and Edward de Vere, which is, I'm sorry, any conspiracy theory that starts with you writing Midsummer Night's Dream when you're 9 years old is not a conspiracy theory worth
so you'll be
considering.
Well, I don't know if I'll be seeing that. Flying around at the time, so I mean, it all ties together.
Yeah, exactly. So, but that always infuriates me. I hate reading books about, I love reading biographies about writers, because I think writers are always interested in how other writers think and feel. But I just read this awful book that was talking about a number of people during the 20s, and among them Dorothy Parker and Edna St. Vincent Millay and Zelda Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. And I was just, they were so completely missing the point. You know, they were, this poem reflects the fact that Dorothy Parker was severely, you know, depressed and her love life had gotten to her. I'm like, the poem is satirical and ironic, and she had a great sense of humor, and you seem to have completely missed that part, you know, and I'm just screaming. I was listening to this on audiobooks and screaming in the car because they were doing this to my poor precious Dorothy Parker and missing the point. So I will be writing my Algonquin Roundtable Dorothy Parker story, but it will be fiction so that I can do what I want. But hopefully
write what's wrong.
Is this really a forthcoming project?
That's a forthcoming short story that I'm working on, yes.
Do you have anything up and coming that you wanted to
talk about? I'm working on, I'm thinking of a couple of novels right now. This one took 8 years, so I'm kind of trying to not dive right into another novel. But I have been wanting to write a UFO novel, which would be all about Roswell and Area 51 in Las Vegas.
So turning away from the Oxford historians then?
For this one. No. Okay, excellent. For this one, just poor harmless person kidnapped by an alien in a car. Spaceship, but in a car. I've always wanted to write a road picture, and this would be my
this
road
would be
picture.
It. That sounds great.
and it would have, one of my pet peeves has always been how Monument Valley moves around the West. It's everywhere. John Ford did not seem to know where it really was, and he kept sticking it in odd places. And then Thelma and Louise came along and did the same thing. I'm like, okay, here's where Monument Valley is. Let's put it where it really is. So I thought I love the West, and I've never really written a book about the West, I think that would be fun.
That sounds great.
That would be great.
And a romantic comedy, of course.
Which, of course.
Of course.
As you're due.
Yes.
For another. Yeah. And if you wanted to do anything about P.G. Woodhouse's life, since you did Drunk Kid Rome already.
That's true. I love P.G. Woodhouse. You're right.
Just throw
right
it out there.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
It was a real honor to meet you and a pleasure to have you here.
Nice to meet you.